Okay, why don't we get started? First of all, I want to say that this is the last brown bag of the year, which is always a sad occasion because of the fact that it doesn't give me anything to look forward to programming-wise until the fall, except for the fact I found out something today to pass along to all of you, so I don't have a flyer on this. But next Thursday, from 12:30 to 1:30 in the Lookout Art Gallery, which is over at the Residential College of Arts and Humanities, there is a folk trio called Potluck, and they're going to be performing coal mining songs and discussing coal mining in West Virginia. So if any of you are up for a little bit of Appalachian and work-related music, it's open to the public and free, so get yourself over to the Lookout Gallery, which is in Snyder Phillips Hall over on Bogue Street. So please do come to that. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct our daily work, Our Daily Lives, which for over 20 years has done programming here on campus. This is the end of our 19th year of the Brown Bag series, and it's amazing. You know, it's almost like we should send it to college, because it's old enough, but I know it's going to embarrass them, but I just want to thank our good friends the Greenwoods for some financial help with underwriting this year's series, which was wonderful on their part, and it's always wonderful to have them in the row, because they often hand out flyers for me if I have a flyer to hand out. But today, this has been a long time coming. And I have to tell you that it was my immense pleasure to finally meet Peter Cole last night when I picked him up off the train, because we've been in touch for years, because it just so happens that we share dock workers. My research actually has to do with Great Lakes dock workers who work on the iron ore loading docks of Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. And Peter and I, you know, there's a small, very small fraternity of, and maybe sorority as well, of people who are working on dock workers, so it's so wonderful to have him here. His earlier work was on Wobblies on the Waterfront in Philadelphia, and the whole notion of really looking at ports and looking at ports in terms of workers having more power than they should rightfully have by virtue of what their occupational type is. It's a strong back. In my case, it's a strong back and a shovel for iron ore trimmers. And but these longshoremen end up with a very, very interesting life. And Peter and I also share with many of the people who are in the room another love, and that is the love of South Africa as well as the United States. So Peter has done work on a comparative basis, which you're going to hear about today, which is part of a larger book kind of project that really looks at two cities, San Francisco and Durban, in terms of their similarities as port cities and in terms of their labor movements. So Peter did his PhD at Georgetown University and currently is in the history department at Western Illinois University. In the greater metropolitan area of Macomb, Illinois. So today, and I want to thank Peter Leggi for having all these wonderful students in the room. It's great to have you here. I want to ask you to sign in on those white sheets, and if you would send those around from the back of the room, it'd be great. Today's talk is co-sponsored by the African Studies Center and also by African American and African Studies here at MSU. And Peter is going to be talking on the topic on the waterfront in Durban and San Francisco, longshoremen and social movement unionism from 1934 to 1994. So please help me in welcoming Peter Cole to Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Thank you very much. Is this microphone working? I talk loud anyway. I appreciate everyone's presence and attention, and especially wanted to thank John Beck and for inviting me to this, and my friend Peter Lim and Chris Root for also being here. I'll try to sort of speak quickly, yet not too quickly, in order to cover the many, many fascinating topics that I want to share with you. There are some people in this room who may not be familiar with the fact that there are many of us who study and are interested in the connections between similarities and differences of South Africa and the United States in our histories. And so just as a quick primer or refresher for some of us who are familiar, why is it even legitimate to study these two countries that some people would think have nothing in common, or just assume that perhaps the United States and South Africa are too different to compare, right? Because we want to be able to compare apples and apples as opposed to apples and oranges. And so just as a little teaser, right, I mean, some of the many things is that many countries from Europe colonized Southern Africa and North America, including the British and the Dutch, although ultimately the Dutch were important in both places, but the British displaced them over time, right? While these Europeans were in these colonial areas, they conquered huge amounts of territory and dominated and ultimately defeated and colonized the indigenous populations in both these places. And in both also, the US and in South Africa, the white settlers came to identify very much with their new lands and came to basically believe that the frontier and conquest experience was central to their own identities, right? And develop, in the case of both countries, powerful mythologies about the nobility of settlement, yeah? So much so that in the United States, we don't even use the word conquest. When we talk about the defeat of native peoples, we talk about settlement as if it was a neutral act, as opposed to, in fact, a defeat, right, of millions of indigenous people. So too in South Africa, right? And also that in both these places, South Africa and the United States, indentured labor was imported from other parts of the world, forced labor, as well as slave labor, different sorts of peoples in the case of both places, resulting in a greater diversity of populations and mixtures of peoples and cultures over long periods of time in both the United States and South Africa. And then the battles over, actually the slavery, divide each country. And then in the post-slavery societies in both South Africa and the United States, where what you have is systems of oppression post-slavery in which non-white peoples are often sort of legally disempowered, created in the US as second-class citizens. Of course, in South Africa, non-whites are not citizens, right? Like actually an important difference. And as we also, perhaps most obviously, including myself, drawn to South Africa originally because of my interest in race relations in America, the long struggle in South Africa against what the racial system that came to be known as apartheid, yeah, the social movements that are built over many decades are successful in some ways at defeating racist legal systems, even if racism still exists in the United States and South Africa, and even if the legacy of inequality still persists in many, many different ways, right? Like, and so that's just a quick taste of why it is that it's legitimate, yeah, to study US and South Africa in common instead of seeing them as too different to actually make comparisons among. Now, it goes without saying there are important differences between these two nations. The most obvious is that in South Africa, 80 to 90% of the people are not white, whereas in the United States, the majority of Americans, for now at least, are still white. And there are differences, cultural, political, and the like. So we're mindful of the differences between these two nations, but also that they're similar enough that many of us have studied South Africa and America in tandem. Yeah, one of the most well-known Americans to do so, of course, was Robert F. Kennedy, who in 1966 visited South Africa, gave a number of really prominent speeches, met Chief Albert Luthuli, who was the head of the ANC at that time, and of which here, actually, you have papers in your Michigan State archives that Peter Lim sort of manages the Africana collection that has all sorts of, I was looking this morning at papers, letters by Luthuli, handwritten, yeah, to the American Mary Louise Hooper. Here, Kennedy meeting, yeah, some Africans in, I think that was in Soweto, yeah. So there's a long, actually, connections between our two nations. I'm not writing a general history of this subject. I am instead writing a sort of a very particular one about dock workers, which I believe is fascinating, but also hopefully very instructive. In how, in both in Durban and in San Francisco Bay Area, there are lots of interesting sort of things, themes to explore. And just in a very short nut or small nutshell, yeah, I am talking today really about how dock workers promote racial equality in their cities and nations, yeah. But I'm also actually work on things that relate to how dock workers in the San Francisco Bay Area protest against oppression in South Africa by refusing to unload ships from South Africa or with South African cargo, as well as in South Africa, how in recent years dock workers have refused to unload weapons from China that were destined for neighboring Zimbabwe that the government would use against protesters in Zimbabwe, right? And so we see what fancy words, right? Transnational, multinational, cross-nation activism, both past and present. Yeah, and I'm also interested very much in technology and how technology changes work. And in the shipping industry, the container, or the simple metal box that we see on the backs of every truck and train and on ships, cargo ships, revolutionizes global trade in many ways, but also revolutionizes the work that dock workers do, right? And so part of my work deals with technology, subjects that I'm not exploring today, but nevertheless gives you a little bit of my larger project. Let me tell you a little about Durban and a little bit about San Francisco, even though we may know something about both. I'll just try and go again quickly. I hate to assume what people know about. San Francisco is a young city, founded in the 1840s, really, as an American place, founded by the Spanish earlier. And of course, native peoples lived in this, what we now call the San Francisco Bay Area. An early photo gives you a sense immediately of the importance of the port. Why is San Francisco sort of desirable to the Spanish and then later to the English and Americans? It's because it's essentially the best harbor on the American West Coast, right? A narrow channel that opens up into this gigantic bay. And in the 20th century, when the United States opened up the Panama Canal, which was completed in 1914, that essentially greater connects the United States west and east coast together by shortening shipping by weeks instead of going all the way around South America, right? And San Francisco is the largest port on the American West Coast, very much linked to the American East Coast thanks to the canal, but also it's in the early 20th century and late 19th, that the United States controls the Philippines, Hawaii, right, Guam, increasingly trade with China, right? And so San Francisco is this central city, right? And that's why it's important. We might think of San Francisco in many other ways as an attractive and fun place, all may be true, but it's really because of support that it becomes this dynamic place, And in the 1960s and 1970s, really, because of what we call containers, a subject I briefly mentioned a minute ago, we see these massive cranes that are needed in order to lift and load large, heavy metal containers onto ships, hundreds and hundreds of these containers per ship. And what happens in cities around the world, actually, including in San Francisco, the harbor used to be on the San Francisco side. The, of course, Golden Gate Bridge spans the mouth of the San Francisco Bay, the Golden Gate, as it was referred to, right, into this wide harbor. Literally, the port moves from San Francisco across to Oakland in the 60s and 70s because San Francisco does not simply have the space to handle the amount of land that's needed in order to warehouse, to basically stash boxes, right? Like, and so now Oakland in the foreground here is actually the main part of the port. So the San Francisco Bay Area, this metropolitan area, which includes the major city of San Francisco, but also Oakland, and is essentially where we have now the active port. Same thing on the Durban side, right? Durban, located in southeastern Africa, this is an early photograph of the harbor where you would come into the harbor from the Indian Ocean. The English basically occupy and conquer what they call the province of Natal, and the city and sort of important place, Durban, again, located down here. And Durban, this is essentially, again, the mouth of Durban Harbor. This is called, in the background, the bluff, because of sort of the big hill, right? In the foreground is called the point, still referred to as such, right? And you get a sense of the industrial nature of Durban as ships will unload, right, on the point and other places. Durban will be the largest port in South Africa, will surpass Cape Town, which had been the primary port for the nation. This is just an image of modern Durban. This is, again, that mouth, right, very narrow mouth between the point and the bluff, and then the working harbor in here. Because Durban is such an important port, and South Africa, a relatively large economy, right, the port of Durban is too small physically, right, and so there's been efforts to essentially build out the port. This image is actually not contiguous. The port of Durban is off this photograph up here, but essentially there's plans in modern Durban to expand the port to try to deal with the reality that containers drastically expand the need for space. Anyone who's ever watched The Wire, I'm happy to talk about The Wire after this talk, but like, there's a whole theme about that in Baltimore. And then early 2000s, same sorts of issues, right? So that's a little about San Francisco and Durban in that regards. Just quickly about the people who live in the San Francisco Bay Area. You may think of San Francisco as a wonderfully and incredibly diverse place, and there's some truth in that. But when it comes to the African-American population, actually, the history of San Francisco is of a very tiny population. Before World War II, maybe 1% of the city of San Francisco was black. And even Oakland, which is now sort of seen as more of a black city, was maybe 3% black before World War II. World War II sparks what's often referred to as the second great migration of African-Americans out of the South, including to the West. Many black Southerners and white Southerners, for that matter, moved into the southeastern Michigan, for instance, in order to work in auto and related industries. So too, many people moved to the West Coast from the South in the 40s to work in shipping and shipbuilding, right? And so as a result of that, really, what we have is an increasingly black population in San Francisco, upward more than 10% in Oakland, a third to maybe 40%. Despite the growing population of African Americans, they are highly segregated in the city of San Francisco, traditionally in a neighborhood called the Fillmore, even though, therefore, most working class whites who worked on the waterfront lived maybe closer to the waterfront. Working class blacks essentially had to travel further to get to work because they couldn't live in the seaside neighborhoods. There's also the Fillmore, incidentally, was a neighborhood that increasingly was black because the Japanese Americans who lived in the Fillmore were kicked out during the World War II internment, right? Like, and so literally Japanese moved out of a neighborhood sometimes called Japantown now, and increasingly occupied by African-Americans, referred to as the Fillmore. Yeah. Then there's a part of San Francisco, southeast part of the city, close to the bay, near where Candlestick Park is, for those of you who know your sports history, right? That's called Bayview Hunters Point. That's another black enclave. In Oakland, the western, i.e. near the port, and the northern parts of the city into southern Berkeley are heavily black, right? And so there's tight residential segregation historically in the Bay Area. And in Durban, the population, we keep in mind in South Africa that the populations of cities are in all cities, underrepresented black, because whites have tried over the 19th and throughout most of the 20th century to essentially keep blacks out of the cities. Cities were literally white places where blacks were allowed to be if they serviced literally the white economy, right? And so despite the demographics of the nation, cities are actually more heavily white than rural, yeah? But in Durban, because of the nature of the geography, right, most of the blacks, Africans in Durban are Zulu, also called AmaZulu, along with some Pondos, which is sort of like a subset of the Xhosa population, which is from the province called the Eastern Cape. Yeah. So we have in Durban a variety of different black Africans. Yeah. We also have blacks being segregated legally by the South African state before the 1990s, and some of the big black townships in Durban you might be familiar with, Umlazi and Kwamashu. And then there's also in Durban a huge Indian population, often referred to in South African parlance as Asian. And the Indian population is imported by the English, another part of the British Empire, in order to work the sugarcane fields, literally 150,000 brought. So that I've heard before, and maybe I could be corrected if I'm wrong, that Durban has the largest Indian population outside of India. It has a huge Indian population of hundreds and hundreds of thousands in Greater Durban nowadays. Among the white people, more Anglo than Afrikaner. Afrikaners were the former Dutch, right? Like, and so considered to be the most English big city in South Africa compared to Johannesburg or Port Elizabeth or Cape Town, right? So that's just a little on these two cities that I spend time in and research. We want to be good scholars here, and so to think a little about the literature of people who are writing about this. I originally come, as Professor Beck was talking about in my introduction, right, interested in connections between race and class in America. The working class in the United States has always been more non-white than the upper class, right? And to this day, immigrants and people of color are more likely to be working class than white Americans are. To study the working class is to study, therefore, race and ethnicity and immigration, right? And for those of us interested in these matters, There's a number of us who study essentially the interconnections between efforts for to fight for racial equality and to fight for essentially what Martin Luther King referred to as unions, the greatest anti-poverty program, right? Because workers who are powerful are able to negotiate for higher wages. So among the most important works in this field is one that came out about a decade ago called Civil Rights Unionism, about black and white tobacco workers, mostly black workers in North Carolina, who were radical because not only did they fight for their to get out of poverty through a union, they actually also fought for racial equality, often linking up with other political groups, especially in the mid-20th century in the Communist Party. The union that I study, which I'll talk much more about, the ILWU, is another one of these unions in the United States, past and present, that have a long history of racial activism. And other scholars who've worked on this, for those of us in the know, Bruce Nelson and Robert Self. In South Africa, similarly, there's a historiography, the study of history, that not surprisingly focuses a lot on racial matters because the history of apartheid sort of is dominates our sort of thinking about and understanding of 20th century South Africa. Sometimes unions were referred to as social movement unions if they were not only fighting for their workers' immediate benefits, like I want a raise, but also fighting against apartheid, right? And so black workers, or I should say the workplace, might be one of the few places that where blacks have power and therefore can leverage that power to fight against oppression. Yeah, and in the context of South Africa, really, it's hard for South Africans to even decouple these matters, right? Because everything is linked to the reality that racism is sort of this overarching dominant theme in 20th century South Africa. And as apartheid is formally instituted in 1948, 1949, although there was racial oppression prior to that, and in the 50s, the big South African Federation of Black Unions is called SACTU. And I'm going to talk more about the Durban strikes later in the presentation, and there are various other scholars who've worked on these matters, including, We also are mindful that in the 20th century that South Africa and the United States were part of a global struggle referred to as the Cold War. Often for younger people, the Cold War seems somewhat hard to imagine because it's already 25 years past. Yeah, but the United States, of course, was in opposition to the Soviet Union and communism, and the Cold War shaped global relations, but also domestic affairs, so that in the United States, to be referred to as a communist was essentially both not only an insult, but potentially a criminal offense, right, in the 1950s and 1960s. But a lot of people who were communists and or other varieties of left wing were often anti-racist. And so in the struggle against racial inequality in America, many of the whites who were active were often also anti-capitalist, or at least critical of capitalism. Yeah, and so what we have is it becomes hard to de-link, as I said, for South Africa and the United States, these political, economic, and racial movements. And so in the United States, a radical left-wing union like the one I'm going to talk about, the ILWU, often experienced persecution from the US federal government as well as state and local governments. On the South African side, there also was something called the Suppression of Communism Act, passed in 1950, that essentially criminalized anyone who was critical of the South African state. And if you were critical of the government, by definition, you must be a communist, even if you're not a formal member of the Communist Party of South Africa, and therefore could literally be jailed or banned or essentially silenced, right? And so in both US and South Africa, what we have is those organizations and individuals that often are activists, right, are persecuted for essentially trying to change their systems from within. And the US and South Africa, i.e. on essentially the same side of the Cold War, at least the governments, that we're mindful of how that plays, right, and impacts, right, those who are agitating for racial equality. Historians love their background. And also, it's that much harder when you talk about two countries in a single presentation, right? And so let me just tell you a little about the industry that I like to talk about, the longshore industry. We just are aware that maybe the oldest industry in the world is sort of trading, and that people trade locally, but they also trade long distance, and that globalization, a term we consider as a modern one, is not a new phenomena, right? That companies or countries and individuals have traded across borders throughout history, and even before we have history, and increasingly in the 1500s, 1600s, and beyond, that shipping is really sort of one of the keys to global capital and global sort of colonialism. Sorry. And the people who work loading and unloading ships are called longshoremen. They work along the shore, right? Although sometimes they're called stevedores, sometimes they're called dockers, dock workers. In Australia, sometimes called wharfies. And that, like, this industry involves, not unlike Mr. Professor Beck was saying before, right, hard labor, manual labor. It would not be uncommon for people to be asked to lift hundreds of pounds, right? Bags of sugar, bags of coffee, that you're moving up and down ladders, that you're moving on a ship that itself might be moving, that it might be raining, that it might be night, right? That this labor was not only hard, but actually very difficult in various other ways, might be cold, right? We are aware that this work is what was referred to as casual, which means essentially that you don't know if you have a job that day, right? Or next week, or next month, right? Depending on how a ship news comes into harbor that's loading or unloading, you might get a job on that ship, but you don't have a job tomorrow necessarily. That's referred to as casual or irregular work. This work is paid poorly because there's a lot of competition. Most of us could lift something if we had to, even if we might lift it badly, even if it might be hard, right? And so we're aware of that very dangerous industry, very long hours. You might have heard the phrase, the ship must sail on time. And so literally people would work 24 to 36 hour shifts, right? You might get a few breaks in there, but not like a break of 2 hours, right? You might get something to drink or eat, right? And so traditionally longshore work is awful, and this is the case across nations and ports, right? But I want to highlight, especially the San Francisco Bay Area in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s, and Durban into the 1970s. These are actually, this is an image from Durban, this is an image from San Francisco. The work not so different, right? The work not so different, even though the society is in some ways very different from each other. And we're again just mindful that nowadays the industry is totally different. Containerization, the loading of these large metal boxes by the hundreds or thousands onto the tops of ships, using cranes, humans involved, but fewer than ever before, right? Changes the industry in a lot of different ways. And I actually work on that, but not talking about that today. So let's talk about the ILWU. Again, attempt to be a quick. The ILWU founded in San Francisco in 1934 in what was called the Big Strike. That was a coastwide strike that was briefly in San Francisco what's called a general strike, in which literally the entire city's economy shut down in July of 1934, and ultimately resulting in the birth of a new union led by a man named Harry Bridges, who was a radical. Sometimes he was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, or the Wobblies, which was an anarchistic left-wing union. Later, he was associated with the Communist Party, although he often denied membership in the Communist Party. There were other radicals in his union, communist Trotskyists, who are anti-communist, but nevertheless communists, like are you might call them anti-Soviet, but nevertheless still sort of critical of capitalism, Wobblies, and the like. And that this left-wing union, born in the 1930s and expanding in the 1940s, become what they're referred to as the Lords of the Docks. Why are they the Lords of the Docks? Is because they essentially take control of the hiring process. They force the employers to accept that the workers get to pick who works when and where. So they control a hiring hall. A company will basically say, we have a ship coming in, we want X number of workers. The union then dispatches them. How does the union dispatch? First of all, they dispatch on a system of equity so that whoever has earned the least amount of work that quarter of the year gets first job, meaning that the least get the most. Very unusual in the history of the country and world, right? But it's because of their socialist ideals that they want to share the work so that everyone basically is able to survive and maybe thrive. That was called the low man out system, right? They also were anti-racist, and I'm gonna talk much more about that in the next few minutes, right? Now the motto of the ILWU is an injury to one is an injury to all. That also was the motto of the Industrial Workers of the World before them. Bridges had been a member of both unions. This motto will be also the motto of many unions in South Africa because of its birth in America and because sailors and others travel and spread the ideas, right? So the idea, of course, is familiar to all of us. We all share something in common, right? That's very comprehensible, right? But the language of an injury to one and injury to all is actually is born in America in the early 1900s. Now, although I'm going to highlight actually the anti-racist history of this union, I also want to be mindful that this union is far from perfect, right? And that there were in this union racial tensions, racial problems, racism, right? Some locals, for instance, in Portland, Los Angeles, were notorious for decades, 1940s, 50s, 60s, really being trying their best to keep blacks out of those local branches, right? And despite the overall union's commitment in theory, in rhetoric to racial equality, in practice, didn't always work, right? Especially, like I said, in Portland and Los Angeles. The International, led by Harry Bridges, often says, in other words, the right thing, but in practice doesn't push its local branches to integrate. But I'm focusing on the San Francisco Bay Area, which arguably was their best example of putting anti-racist language into practice. So in after World War II, for instance, there was a decline of work. It would have been reasonable, therefore, for them to kick out their most recent members in order to share more of the work among the few who had been around longer. And most of those new members were black. But this union chose, essentially, to keep all the blacks in, even though it would mean, essentially, that everyone would make less money. Because if you have more members, you have fewer dollars earned, right? And so this union made a conscious decision in the late 1940s to keep its ranks larger, keep it integrated and black significant membership, even though that resulted, in the short term at least, in essentially a declining paycheck per member, right? Highly unusual, to say the least, right? So when the ILWU do this, by the mid-1960s, this union, the local branch, the Bay Area, is black majority, and we're starting to see them elected at local office, right? President of the local, secretary, treasurer of the local, what's called dispatcher, which is more important, actually, is the person who helps to decide who gets those jobs every day. Other things that the union does in order to promote the social movement idea, right, is that they promoted black hiring in other industries. So, for instance, the first black streetcar driver in San Francisco was this man. When he first got a job working, driving a streetcar, he was beaten up the first day he gets a job, right? And his fellow workers didn't want to work with him, right? The union and I study actually voluntarily on their free time essentially traveled on these streetcars to protect him, to be bodyguards, right? So he wouldn't get beaten up by anyone, whether it was a patron or another white worker, right? 1960, this union is famous for, in 1960 at City Hall, where this anti-communist congressional committee called HUAC held hearings, and they subpoenaed a man named Archie Brown, who was a communist member of the Local 10, to speak. A lot of people, in retrospect, think about it as famous because a lot of students from University of California, Berkeley, went to protest also. And that part of the story is true, but it leaves out the fact that there were hundreds of dock workers also present at these protests to defend one of their own members who refused to testify, saying that he had essentially the First Amendment right to believe as he wished. Another example of this sort of union's commitment to fight racism was this union took part of its pension, which is invested in things like, say, stocks, right, and took that money and built a housing development in the early 1960s in San Francisco, in actually the old Fillmore, the old Japantown, which is also very close to their international headquarters, called St. Francis Housing Cooperative, St. Francis being, of course, a famous Catholic man, and opened this up to people of all ethnicities and races, very consciously created the first privately operated integrated housing development in the city of San Francisco, and made it also affordable enough that working class people could buy in, right? And this is still around, St. Francis Housing Co-op, right? And its first organizer was this guy, Revels Caton, who was a famous black maritime unionist in the ILWU, so you can visit this place if you wish. Or in 1964 in San Francisco, a famous civil rights protest, when they were fighting it locally, they were giving support to the Southern freedom struggle, but they also were fighting to basically get local employers to hire more blacks, especially in the hotel industry, San Francisco having a long tourism industry, right? And so the fighting of these was called the Sheraton Palace Hotels, where a bunch of people sat in. A lot of people don't know that the ILWU actually helped broker the deal between essentially the protesters and the mayor. Or in 1968-69, where San Francisco State, then San Francisco State College, now San Francisco State University, basically fought to create more classes on black studies, Indian studies, Latino, Chicano studies, and Asian American studies. The LWU actually, this guy is now in the Local 10, but his father was in Local 10. He was actually a leader in the strike, right? And so the children of Local 10 members became activists also in some cases. And a lot of people also might know that in San Francisco in 1969, American Indians of different tribes occupied Alcatraz Island for a year and a half. A lot of people don't know that one of the members of Local 10 was an Indian, this man, who secured the pier. And that basically all the boats that went between the island and the city, and they didn't have water on the city, on Alcatraz. It had no water. So everything that went to support for a year and a half that essentially action was because this Local 10 member had secured basically an unused wharf for all the comings and goings of the Alcatraz activists, right? Totally unknown aspect of this. I could go on, but on the San Francisco side, but basically sort of most importantly, as I mentioned earlier, they took lots of African Americans into their ranks, and they actually actively recruited in poor neighborhoods, right? When they were expanding their numbers, they recruited among essentially underrepresented groups, not only African Americans, but including them. And Bill Chester, who's pictured here, was the most well-known African American leader of this union. They also fight to integrate other branches of the union that had been slow. And finally, Martin Luther King Jr. visited the Local 10 in 1967, the year before he was murdered, and was made an honorary member, right, for that. So that's quickly. On the Durban side, quickly also, Durban dock workers in unions, sometimes in unions, but not always in unions, but nevertheless, workers organizing, sometimes unofficially or informally, will often agitate for their own benefits. Most usually, we need raises because we get paid really awfully. But also, you can never understand, essentially, black worker activism in the 20th century without appreciating that it also has implications for the state of apartheid, right? That, in other words, when blacks demonstrate power, that's understood by all sides as a threat to the state, right? And so we understand that labor power is crucial in the anti-apartheid movement. And so where were black workers powerful? Very few places in the 1960s and 1970s. And so Durban is an example of that. So just like in San Francisco and other ports, work was considered casual, meaning before modern times, you get hired for the ship to work loading or unloading it, as these men are doing, unloading hides. Unloading meat and hides is actually some of the nastiest work you can get, right? Because this stuff is basically rotting, right, as you're trying to move it off or on. There are some dock workers who organize unions and other workers who organize unions, but many South Africanists know the Industrial and Commercial Workers Union, ICU, which was the biggest union in the 1920s and 30s across South Africa and other parts of Southern Africa. The ICU was born out of a strike on the Cape Town docks in 1919, right after World War I. Their motto, an injury one is an injury to all, right? In later years, in the mid-20th century, there was a union called the South African Railway and Harbor Workers Union that organized both railroad and port workers into the same union. In the 1940s, as in San Francisco, an increase of work results in workers having some more power. Because the government needs this stuff moved, the workers have leverage, right? And so we see some strikes percolating in the 40s and in the 50s led by, at this time, a guy named Zulu Pingula. When South African employers and the government don't like dock workers go on strike, they fire everybody. Right? It's called retrenchments in South Africa. And they send them back. If you have no work in the city, you actually have to go back to the rural, quote, homeland that you're from. And so you're sent back to rural KwaZulu. Right? So that's the way, essentially, the government and the employers deal with activism. They fire the lot, replace them. Right? And what's interesting is that every time they're replaced, another group of workers come in, they also become activists, right? So in the 50s and 60s, there was a union, a group of unions called SACTU, the South African Congress of Trade Unions. An injury to one is an injury to all. They would undertake political strikes in the late 50s, essentially staying away from work, i.e. strike, in order to protest apartheid. And Durban dock workers were part of these stay-away campaigns in 59 and 60. And because workers essentially had some power, in 1959, the South African government reorganized the labor process in Durban to try to restrict or reduce Durban dock worker power, right? And throughout both pre and post apartheid, before apartheid and during apartheid, dockers in the Durban area were put up in what were called hostels. basically dormitories, right, near the workplaces. And so although most blacks actually lived in these townships that were actually far removed from the city, dock workers were unusual in that they were essentially put into housing right by the docks because we need these people to work maybe 24/7 nights and weekends, right? And so these hostels were where dockers lived. Now, the benefit of dockers from the hostels from the perspective of organizing is that all these people live together. They get to know each other, they get to talk with each other, they make connections with each other, right? They can organize in all these informal ways simply because they spend lots of time together, right? Unlike normally where you go to your various different communities. So I'll spend a few minutes on it, but the last theme I want to highlight is how dock workers play a really important role in the anti-apartheid resurgence. Some dockers and other Durban unionists are involved in the underground resistance movement in South Africa called Spear of the Nation, or Mkhonto we Sizwe, or MK. And although the general history of the anti-apartheid movement understands that the Durban strike wave in 1973 is vital to reigniting the struggle in the 70s, that a lot of people don't appreciate that dock workers were essentially very important in shaping that. Right? And so to understand the Durban strikes, I'm suggesting we need to give more credit to the Durban dock workers, folks like Kernik Ndluvu, who was an activist in multiple fronts in the 50s and into the 60s. Kernik Ndluvu, who was from a rural area west of Durban, but his family moved as a child to Durban, he ends up working like his father on the docks in the 50s, becomes active in union campaigns, but also in the African National Congress, the ANC, in the 50s. After essentially the ANC is banned, goes underground, right? Part of the MK, the armed resistance, arrested and thrown into prison with Mandela and Robben Island for 20 years, comes out in the 80s, becomes active in the United Democratic Front in the mid 80s, right? And so what we see is essentially a lot of the people involved in the anti-apartheid movement were also using their connections to and power among workers for their benefit. Dock workers in particular in Durban. In 1969, dock workers in Durban go on strike. One of the first strikes in the 60s after a massive wave of repression in the early 60s. 1971, they threaten to strike. They're fired. In 1972, they go on strike again. So in late 1972, dock workers in Durban strike. They strike partially because radical white students who are at the University of Natal, Durban, who are students of a radical white professor named Rick Turner, who's a legendary figure in South Africa, is teaching these people about activism, critical of apartheid, also had been trained in Paris and was a Marxist, but a radical, not communist, but nevertheless anti-capitalist. Turner basically excites radical white students who help organize black workers in 1971, 72. They go on strike in late 1972 for wage increases. And just a month and a half later, other workers go on strike, most famously in a place called Coronation Brick. It's the first group of black workers in January 73. Ultimately, over 60,000 workers go on strike over the next few months. And the Durban strike wave is legendary in the history of modern South Africa as basically being the first large-scale resistance on the parts of blacks to economic and political repression since in a decade, what referred to the late early 60s to the early 70s, the quiet decade, because there was very little repression had succeeded in basically shutting down, right? And so essentially, I'm suggesting that the Durban strikes need to be better understood in the context of the Durban dock workers who were striking literally on the eve of the Durban strike wave. Now, importantly, unlike in San Francisco, Durban dock workers are less capable of resisting containerization, and so Durban dock workers power diminishes in the late 70s and early 80s, which is when most black workers are becoming more activist, right? And so actually Durban dock workers disappear for a decade or so from action on these matters because essentially they're on their backs, right? Like, and so we're mindful of that. To wrap this sort of rush, I'm suggesting that dock workers in Durban and the Bay Area were pivotal in their local economies and have long histories of militancy, that despite the Cold War, that essentially they're involved in multiple social movements, although I've highlighted today racial equality as the social movement that I'm focusing upon in both Durban and in San Francisco. But that when that in the history of Durban and the history of the San Francisco Bay Area, these stories are not unfamiliar. People are familiar with them. However, in the national stories, these stories drop out, right? So when you study the American anti-apartheid movement, labor generally, and the dock workers in San Francisco specifically, aren't really talked about. Or in the civil rights struggle in the 1960s and 70s in America. By the same token, in literature in South Africa, the Durban strikes are seen as important, but the Durban dock workers are not, right? In other words, they're sort of left out of the literature, right? And since that's sort of why I'm trying to insert this into the conversation. I hope I didn't speak too quickly, and thank you for your time. I've tried to rush so I can have plenty of time for conversation among you folks. Thank you very much for your
attention. Well, I'm sure that everybody's got a lot of questions or comments, so let me just open the floor. Who wants to weigh in? Somebody want to weigh in early? Peter.
I really like this that you brought in the 72 strikes. There's been this rather mechanical approach to the periodizing of South Africa, rather mechanical approach by historians and others to periodizing struggle, almost to the extent that you have to periodize it around 73 and 76 and 1960 when ANC and others banned, but when SACTU, the Trade Union Federation, is not banned. And although you can ban organizations, it's very hard to make people stop talking or to make people stop reading and thinking. And so, despite this wonderful early historiography that you mentioned, Dave Henson, and I must admit to being one of the few people patient enough to read his 700-page unpublished dissertation, Neil might have also read it. The sort of question or the point I'm making is the hidden history here, partly discoverable through oral history, but also by looking at the cracks and getting away from the orthodoxies and saying, well, in turn, 72, strike, gee whiz, so what, where did it come from? So let's look at the 60s, let's look at the late 50s. And so I think we need to ask about the absences. We need to ask about the vernacular, what's happening in the spoken language. If this is Zulu, how those guys are relating back to the rural areas, what sort of stories are they carrying back, or even in the urban areas, what is being spoken about in pubs, on street corners, how are people relating their lives? John started off by talking about folk songs about coal mines of West Virginia. I wonder what we know about how the black dock workers in Durban, or maybe even in San Francisco, how they memorialize their own lives. It's very hard work in song or in chant. Because we know out of Durban is also coming some very vibrant oral poetry. It tends to be published in the 70s and 80s, Arisitis and others. The question really is about how do we spot oral history into all of this?
Well, it's a good question, and or many comments in there. Like, so in the history of South Africa, right, so much emphasis placed on the history of the fight against apartheid, understandably so. And so what that means is that in the early 60s, there's this flurry of activism and repression, and then essentially what Peter Lim was saying, that in 1970, then there's nothing, supposedly. You're in band, you're killed, you're in prison, you're in exile. And so nothing's supposedly happening in country. And then suddenly in 73, the strike breaks out. And then from that point forward, then there's more activism happening. And so what's happening in that decade? And the answer is there's very little done on that, right? Like, and so this local resistance in country, although Oliver Tambo and others have left the country and are agitating to build a worldwide movement in country, what's happening, right? And the answer is it actually can be very hard to document, right, 50, 60 years later. Right, as well as sort of if you're like me from the United States as opposed to from South Africa or Durban, right? And then trying to sort of get this either through talking or through interviews or through written records. Yeah, and sometimes there's a lot of absence or silence, right? Like Peter Lim was just saying. And so looking at those matters is really interesting and important, can be hard to get at. For instance, I showed an image and mentioned a guy named Kernik Ndulubu. He was actually interviewed in the late 1980s. And it's you can look at this record, this written transcript in Durban. And he's interviewed about like essentially why he was thrown in prison. And he said, well, I was involved in various day-to-day activities. You know, totally vague, right? Why? Because apartheid's still ongoing. He's being interviewed during apartheid about his activism. And of course, he says nothing of real specific use. Understandably so, and now has passed away, right? Like, and so what do you do with that, right? So as historians or other scholars, how do you find information? Often talking to people is one way, but sometimes there's a lack of information, and sometimes we try to connect the dots with what we have, which may or may not be sufficient, right? Like studying the power system is easier because they leave a paper trail. Studying resistance can be harder, right, because they may not have written anything down, right, or it might have been lost, right, like, and so these are matters that I think are interesting for historians and other scholars to try and interrogate, and I do my best to do, but the Durban side is harder for me, for many reasons, because of that, right, like,
Let me play with you on two matters, Peter, and then see other folks who might want to chime in. I guess you raised something. Let me first make a comment about this issue of a quiet period, because a lot of folks look back at Bernstein's work on the 20s and the 30s, in the one case the lean years, in the other case the turbulent years. And the 20s are often regarded as kind of a quiet decade by comparison, because American labor gets the stuffing kicked right out of it and a number of strikes in the early 20s. But the interesting thing is that there were a number of social institutions that were building toward the 30s. Worker education movements, worker education school, I mean actual training schools, a variety of other things, cooperative banks. I mean, there are a great many things during the quiet period that in fact lay the basis for what ends up being turbulent later. Because a lot of times I think there's this always this kind of surprise. Oh, look, out of nowhere comes, you know, the 1973 strikes. Well, they don't come out of nowhere, right? They were ramped to in one way or another. Same thing, I think, in terms of what we did here in the 1930s. But let me play with you about this whole issue of respectability, because could it be that longshoremen are looked at as kind of a dangerous sort of folks, and therefore they're easy to leave out of the historiography? Social movement unionism in the United States, often the person that gets talked about is Walter Reuther, right? So the UAW is standing on some of these same kind of things, but as you've alluded to the fact that the ILWU kind of gets swept aside, because Reuther is a respectable guy. He leads the auto workers. Auto workers are regarded as, at that time, the real start of kind of the middle class American dream, you know, and a social movement unionism that looks more respectable than people who are accused on the one side on longshore of being criminals, you know, thugs and everything else in terms of controlling the waterfront, and on the other of being communists. I mean, I guess it would seem to me that it's part of a very conscious amnesia in terms of picking one as a symbol rather than the other as a symbol, if that makes sense.
Well, another good professor has a long comment, and there's many things I could comment upon, right? So, I mean, as for on the Durban side, in this quiet period, right, like we might think about, for instance, how in what the government would do is they'd fire everybody, send them back to rural KwaZulu and try to hire out people who were new to the work, therefore maybe not radicalized, right? And so then the question is, how come then new waves of workers, literally an entirely new workforce in some cases, suddenly becomes activist too, right? So A, it seems reasonable to conclude that maybe not everyone's fired, but people are talking, right? Like, two, the work itself radicalizes people, right? And so by working together, you see a common interest, gang labor. You know, I always joke, professors, right? I work by myself. I don't necessarily have solidarity with other professors, even though we might have common issues because I work so much by myself, right? Dock workers work in gangs, right? In the case of the South Africa, they live also together, right? And in the case of Durban, they're almost entirely of the same ethnic group, right? And so what we see is that there's multiple factors that help explain why the attempts to squash resistance fails, right? Although you might say that actually it's interesting because those same things happen in other industries more successfully in South Africa, that this industry in this city actually has much more activism than many other cities and industries, right? Like, and so, but then that's why comparison also is interesting, because we see, oh, what do you know, in many other cultures, in many other parts of the world, we see history of dock workers, right? And so this industry, right, like mining is another classic example, where there's a greater likelihood where workers see each other as essentially brothers, and therefore willing to fight for each other, not just for themselves, right? And so we think about the nature of the work, right, is very important. As for sort of, you know, in the United States side, the union I study is a relatively small union, and because of its radical nature, is considered, like Professor Beck said, really sort of on the fringe, right? The UAW has 1 million members. The ILWU has 60,000 members, right? The UAW is really sort of the union driving, if you weigh the conversation in the 50s and 60s about the labor movement on race, because they have 100,000 black members, right? Like, whereas the ILWU has thousands of black members, right? Like, and so there are many unions, or not many, but a decent number of unions in the US that are sort of also agitating on similar matters, right? Like, and that the labor movement generally, I think, gets short shrift in the US anti-apartheid movement, which often gives a lot of credit to the student activism on campuses like Michigan State, where the first university to divest, right, according to Professor Beck, and or religious groups. And so if we think of essentially the global anti-apartheid movement as a three-legged stool, church folk, student folk, labor folk. But often in America, the labor folk get left out, right? And so part of my work sort of speaks to that matter. UAW was involved also. When Mandela comes in 1990 to visit the United States on his Thank You America tour, part one, he visits about 7 cities in his 10-day tour. Detroit's one of them, right? He puts on a UAW jacket and hat because he knows that they were central to the fight. When he goes to the Bay Area, his last stop, he doesn't put on an ILWU hat or jacket, but he spends 10% of his speech before 60,000 people praising Local 10 for their actions, right? And so Mandela, now forgotten, right now is a saint, right? But was often called during his lifetime a communist, right? Because he was an anti-apartheid activist in prison for life, yeah, because of his activism. And so we think about these matters, and again, I'm one theme in my work is the anti-apartheid stuff, and I like the fact that, of course, the Durban dock workers involved, but also the San Francisco dock workers. I've interviewed a bunch of Bay Area dock workers who were essentially the leaders in that in the 70s and 80s in the Bay Area, creating actions in solidarity, right?
Other questions? Did Neil, did you have a comment back there? Or?
It gets very controlled. And if you study the UAW or Walter Ruther, he concentrates very much on containing, by containing the left and then getting rid of. Mm-hmm. And, the question of integration is all more adapted to the American context. But it becomes very controlled. And I just wonder, in the South African case, that once the question of dignity somewhat answered, does this social unionism, which we begin to see, begin to diminish?
Right. Well, that's a good question. So, like, the issue of dignity, I think, is really important. Famously, when Martin Luther King was killed, he's giving a support to a Memphis sanitation worker strike, and the motto on the you see across this Memphis strike in 1968 is, I am a man, right? And so they actually wanted a union and raises, but they also actually wanted it can be hard. I don't think we should decouple these matters. In Durban, dock workers in Zulu were often called buffalo, right? Not humans, right? Because what was their work? It required strength, right? And that was seen essentially that humans' labor was animalistic, right? So we're mindful of that. In contemporary South Africa, the dock worker union that I study, the South African Transport and Allied Workers Union, is now the name of the union. identifies as a social movement unionism. And these terms are still used right in South Africa. And so what does that mean? Well, there are splits right now within the labor movement over essentially how to deal with the reality that South Africa, 20 years after the end of apartheid, still has incredible amounts of poverty among the poor and the black, right? And that to say you're poor is essentially to say you're black, right? Because so many blacks are still poor, and that transformation, quote unquote, has been slow, if sort of not happening, right? And some unions have basically split away from, just in the past few months, in order to try and sort of bring those issues, because they feel they've been captured essentially by the leading political party, the ANC, right? Which is maintains power, but is not doing enough, arguably, for the majority of South African people, right? And that this has also percolated into resulting in this important rift, really the most important rift in the labor movement since 1994, right, where a handful of unions have split, right? And so this is an ongoing matter, right? And in the American context, social movement unionism, to sort of use this term, right, has multiple facets to it, but one of the important ones is the battle over immigration, right? Where for many decades, the labor movement was officially opposed to high-level immigration, because understandably so, people say, well, immigrants are competition for work. I therefore want to limit immigration. Over time, immigration has changed America in a lot of ways, and especially as Latin Americans have come into the United States, so that now the AFL-CIO and other unions that are not affiliated are actually in favor of essentially legalization of undocumented workers, right? Because the labor movement has changed, right? And I would include, therefore, really immigration, right, as a matter for social movement unionism, because so many working class Americans are Latino, right, or either Mexican American or immigrants. And so therefore, these issues aren't limited to race, right, but what we would call in the US ethnicity, right? And that the labor movement in the US has actually flipped 180 degrees and become a strong advocate for essentially providing a pathway to citizenship for 10 million residents of the US, right? South Africa, just as, in case you were unaware, just has experienced another bout of terrible xenophobic riots in which a number of foreigners have been murdered by South Africans just in the last few weeks, right? A sort of resulting in another round of soul searching on the part of South Africa. How could we, supposedly this rainbow nation, engage in murder, right? Like of foreign residents, right? And the answer is that in both countries, right, we're seeing similar issues again, right? Like over relatively wealthy economies pulling in workers from relatively poorer places like Zimbabwe or Mozambique or further in northern Africa. And how does South Africa, the labor movement, and the state deal with that? Right? I suggest that the labor movement actually has important roles to play if they're not too slavish to the political party in power. Right? If they act as a lever of power or pushing as opposed to simply a stamping of whatever the current government says should happen, right? Like, so can unions be forces of social change even if they are no longer in a system where racial oppression is the legal system, right? I think that's an interesting question to see how it, 2015, right? So yeah, your discussions of the 50s and 60s are accurate, but so too now even, right? Because I'm always about connecting past and present in my interests.
Other comments, David, and then over to Dorothy?
On the question of why the Durban strikes are missing from the national political narrative, I wonder about the ethnic factor playing here. But I sense that there's a lot in the central core ANC that looks at Durban as the place where Inkatha created, resisted us, and even shot at Mandela the first time he visited Durban afterwards.
Yeah.
And also it's the place of Indians, and it's Indian Congress.
Right. I think he knows more about South Africa than me, but like, you know, KwaZulu-Natal, the province where Durban is located, is unusual within South Africa, like Professor Wiley was saying, and mostly Zulu, which is the largest ethnic group in Africa, in South Africa, but Xhosas like Mandela and Mbeki and Tambo were dominant within the ANC, and so there are inter-ethnic rivalries, past and present in South Africa. In the 80s and 90s, there were rivalries between ANC and a Zulu organization called Inkatha that resulted in literally mass violence thousands of people killed on both sides in the 80s and 90s, really sort of shocking. And very hard to untangle, right? Because I've thought about this in the context of the Durban docks, where you have a Zulu workforce. Zulus, rural Zulu, is supposedly pro-Inkatha, right? But actually also very good union members, and generally Inkatha try to use unions as a tool rather than really empower workers to improve their lot, right? And that the hostels aren't in the townships, right? And the townships were where the ANC and the UDF had their strongholds, right? And so what you have is this civil war going on in KwaZulu-Natal in the 80s and early 90s. Where did the dock workers? We don't see any violence, to my knowledge, in the hostels, right? Infighting or whatnot. But trying to sort of disentangle these matters, the union that they ultimately become a part of are part of the Congress Alliance, meaning they support ANC. They're not supporting Inkatha, yet some of these people are probably Inkatha supporters, right? And the answer is, I don't have a good answer, right? I don't know how to explain this, and I'm not even sure what I would argue about it. But I'm mindful of it. I've tried to investigate it and don't have, fortunately, I'm not yet, my book's not out, right? I'm not sure even how to sort of disentangle these matters. Is it important? I think it's important, right? But what do I say, what do I conclude? I'm honestly not sure, right? I think it's one of the reasons that these unions are relatively weak at the time, right? There are splits within, essentially, unions that comprise mostly of Zulu members, right, in KwaZulu-Natal in the 80s and 90s, right? And even today, perhaps, right? Although less so, I think. So these are complicated, right? I think it does weaken them as unions, but it's not clear to me, essentially, is the waterfront a site of struggle in this war? I'm not sure if it is, actually. I think other people have written some really thoughtful things about these sorts of battles over Inkatha and UDF in the 80s and 90s, and I use them, but I'm not fully clear. And as a comparative historian, there's no other side to this, right? Nothing is happening like this in the Bay Area. And so part of me actually wants to even not ignore it, but I'm not sure if it is part of my even project, right? Even though it's part of the project, right? I'm open to suggestions if people want to offer me some, because you've covered something that I've thought a lot about but don't have good answers to, right? I guess that's all I'll say.
Dorothy?
Now or in the past?
Well, either one, but
yeah.
So that they have some chance.
Well, so I mean, before 1994, which was the first democratic elections that ushered in multiracial democracy, from the 40s onward, Africans, black Africans, were subject to what was called Bantu education, Bantu being a language group that many of the different ethnic groups speak languages that are part of Bantu languages in South Africa. And they had a system of education that was very rigidly controlled from the central government that was purpose was essentially to disempower, right? And many blacks understood this so that over time, actually, there was a rejection of Bantu education because it was understood that it was basically menial at best, right? Now, some blacks seek out education formally and in informal ways in order to empower themselves individually, but also as a people. Right, and so that was ongoing. And white South Africans had an entirely different parallel educational system that was far better resourced, but also whose purpose was to actually educate for individual advancement. Right, post 94, right, education has been one of the major battlegrounds over what often is called in South Africa transformation. Right, as in how do we achieve it? And so many tertiary or higher educational institutions now have significant numbers of non-white South Africans, and some of them majority non-white, right? The faculties are increasingly diverse, but slower to transform, right? So mostly white faculty at universities across South Africa today. And just like in America, there are big battles over education because I'm an educator, right? It's not easy. Many South Africans today feel like the educational system still doesn't do service to essentially the desires of ordinary South Africans, right? And that there are still sort of major inequalities based on wealth and race in contemporary South Africa, right? And so really, when we think about South Africa, we have to sort of go pre and post 1994, yeah? Just like in America, I mean, depending on the region, up through the 1970s, African Americans' educational opportunities were so limited, right, compared to post, two, right? But in South Africa, dock workers would have had, at best, what we would call a primary school education, right? Like, although nowadays, dock workers are very likely to have secondary education, and in some cases, even higher than that. It's a relatively skilled and well-paying work, and so attractive, and so, and the work has somewhat changed over time. So the educational levels of Durban dock workers have changed also, actually, over time, from what little I know about it.
Dorothy, just want to aside that other people in the room, many people know even better far than I do, but well over half of the youth between the ages of 16 and 26 are not in education, not in employment, not in training. They're called NEETs. So NEETs, not in education, not in employment, not in training. So that's the actual thing that's, but this is a high unemployment country. So you, and high unemployment, especially among black Africans. So that it's not like, I think we often take near full employment here in the United States for granted. In the South African context, employment and unemployment are extreme issues. And one thing, just an aside, Peter, that maybe you're aware of or unaware of, but in some of the strikes in Port Elizabeth, not on the docks, but in the plants, family members would scab on family members, specifically because it was the only way to make sure that the family still had a wage coming in. Mm. And it was with the approval of the worker, from the point of view that the strike was still a strike, but you still had to keep money coming into the household. Mm. Whereas that kind of reality of scabbing on your own family in the United States might have happened in some places, but very rarely, because we automatically sent up a real interdict around what constitutes a picket line and everything else. But let me ask all of us to please thank Peter Cole for a wonderful presentation. If you have further questions, please come up and ask. And please do come back in the fall to our Daily Work of Daily Lives. We're very happy that you're all here. And thanks again to Peter for bringing all these wonderful students here today. Thanks.